This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
...of historic audio from the Pacifica Radio Archives right here on KPFT Houston.
Welcome to another edition of the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning on, I don't even know what the date is. My one-year-old got a hold of my watch and started pushing all the buttons. It's a digital watch. And the date is 0000.
Fallible technology.
00. So that brings me to my next story. Those of you expecting to hear the interview with Bill McGibbon, we had it. We conducted it on Monday before he appeared at the Progressive Forum, and it was a terrific, terrific interview. There was great energy. We talked about a lot of ideas, and then I got home and was getting dressed to get ready to go see a Bill appear at the Progressive Forum. And I had a few minutes while I waited for my dad. I took my dad to his first Progressive Forum event, and I said, "Oh, I think I'll just kind of review the interview." And I took out this voice recorder, and I pushed the button on it, and I sat there and I listened, and it was going and going, and nothing came out of this recorder. And so, yours truly managed to have a terrific interview, and it didn't get recorded. This is the old, if the tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? And I can tell you the answer is no, it does not make a sound. The sad thing is that I had gone out earlier in the day and bought my own digital voice recorder. And previously, when I've done these interviews with Progressive Forum and Randall Morton, I've used the one from the station. But the folks in the news department, they use these things every day. They use them. I'm sure they put a lot of miles on them, and they should. But it's my concern that, you know, I don't know if I pick one up, take it out of the station, what the battery life is going to be on it. Is the disc on it going to be full? And so that day I was nervous, and I said, I better go get one of these myself. I just don't want anything to go wrong with one of the interviews. And so I went out. I got it. We tested it for an hour. And lo and behold, that happened. And so I'm so sorry, and I was especially sorry to Bill McGibbon and to Randall Morton, so much so I've asked Randall to join me here in the studio today to make amends.
Hi,
welcome, Randall. How are you?
Yeah, don't worry about it. You did a good job. It was a good
interview. It was a really good interview, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, and that happens. That very evening at the event, something happened to the sound system at the Wortham. You know, the good folks, the technical crew, I guess, you know, had one of these FEMA microphones. And
it was your
and it went out for four minutes. We had no sound, so we had to, you know, just go to the front of the stage and, you know, the old-fashioned way, shout out to the audience. But something happened with the Yamaha board.
It was your question and answer session, and nobody in the audience really could empathize with how those guys in the technical crew at the Wortham Center were feeling more than I. I mean, I was sitting there in the audience thinking, oh my God, if anybody knew what those guys are going through, and Randall had to have been climbing the walls, but he was totally, totally cool about it and said, folks, we're a community and we'll get through this. And we did. And then the next morning I had to send Randall, after I knew that he'd had this microphone problem at the Wortham Center, that I had to send him an email saying, oh, and by the way, the interview that we spent 30 minutes on, it didn't get recorded either. What's the point of all this? I've been trying to reflect over the past few days, and what comes to my mind is fallibility, right? I mean, we live in this universe. We live in this world where things go wrong. Things go wrong. Things go wrong with every one of us. Every day, things go wrong. And especially now that we have so much technology, things go wrong. Things will go wrong. Things that we don't expect will go wrong could go wrong. And it's very important that we accept that. We accept that every day things are going to go wrong. And that there's going to be fallibility as well. We're seeing right now in a political campaign, a fierce political campaign, different candidates, you know, jockey for the position of being righter, more correct, having had a personal history of not having made mistakes, and blah, 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 and so on. And it's unreasonable for us to expect total infallibility in anything that we do.
Maybe it's forgiveness. Maybe we should be talking about forgiveness.
We should be talking about forgiveness. I think that's exactly right.
You know, Bill and I let go of this, you know, the moment we heard it was no big thing. And maybe you need to forgive yourself.
He wrote me one sentence. He wrote, we asked him to come on today on Thursday, and he said, I'm sorry, and he would be here, he said, except that he's teaching a class. And then the next sentence, one more sentence, and then he was out. He said, these things happen. These things happen.
They do. And the good folks at the Wortham are trying to figure out what happened. I met with them the next day. They still don't know whether it's Operator Air or, you know, the Omaha board. They don't know. And they've been at it for years.
We've had, we've had, like, our music interlude the past couple of weeks burped, right, Bob and Laura? I mean, things happen with technology. Bob's pointing to himself. Bob's a former a pilot in the Air Force. And so things go wrong there, right? I mean, things happen. Things happen.
We call it a hiccup.
A hiccup. So, really, as you go through your daily lives, dear listeners, and you either expect everything to go all right with yourself in your life, or you expect everything to go all wrong.
I think about McGibbon, and he talks about contentment. And we're at such an adrenal level. High adrenal level. We live this manic life to keep up, to expect, and it's just so hyper.
It's hyper.
It wears us out. And it's, you know, part of the media fervor that you were talking about with Obama. It's just so unreasonable. It's just so unreasonable.
Right. Exactly.
That makes no sense.
So as you go through your lives and you expect it all to go right or all to go wrong, you know, We must understand that some is going to go right and some is going to go wrong. Now, what's important about fallibility is that we learn from it. That's really important, right? Now that the screw up of the digital recording device has bitten me once, it's not forgivable. It's forgivable. It's forgivable. It's always forgivable. But I've got to work hard to see that I take steps that it doesn't happen again, right? We have to learn from fallibility. And I think that one of the things that people are most upset about in our country, maybe in all countries, maybe with all governments, is that we seem to make mistakes at the governmental level in the country repeatedly, and learning doesn't take place. To me, that's really not a good thing.
Yeah,
we should be learning from mistakes.
It's an attitude problem. You know, if the government has this constant showdown mentality, there's no learning.
Right. Let's take the Vietnam War. We went to war in Vietnam. And it's amazing to me the parallels between the war in Iraq and the war in Vietnam. I understand the time is different. The The circumstances are different, but essentially, if you look at it, we have the same structure in place. And invasion on what appear to be, in both of them, trumped up charges. In the case of the war in Vietnam, there was this Gulf of Tonkin incident that we learned later was hyped up. And then the injection of U.S. forces in for a long, drawn-out battle in what essentially was a civil war that occurred between the people of Vietnam and the discussion by our government with the American people that our vital interests were at stake and we had to defend them. Oftentimes, those interests were not fully and totally defined. It was defined as an ideological battle with communism. And the same thing taking place in the Middle East, in the case of Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction that didn't turn up, the link between Saddam Hussein's government and the murderers of 9/11, a link which has never proven to be true, the subsequent injection of U.S. forces into Iraq, the statement of our principal interest being at stake, but it not being stated in terms of what it really is there, which is petroleum, but being stated in terms of ideology. The President of the United States stating that this is an ideological battle for the next century between militant Islam and the United States. And the parallels are there. And so we proved that strategy was fallible in Vietnam, and yet here we are repeating it. Many of the same principles behind that war, repeating it a second time.
Yeah, it makes you question human nature. Why aren't we learning?
Why aren't we learning?
You know, 30 years later, we're making the same mistakes. You know, this pathology of power.
Tom Friedman, Randall's got an op-ed out. Dumb as we want to be, he says it's great to see that we finally have some national unity on energy policy. Unfortunately, the unifying idea is ridiculous. It's unworthy of the people aspiring to lead our nation. Hillary Clinton has decided to line up with John McCain in pushing to suspend the federal excise tax on gasoline. This is 18 cents a gallon, and that money goes to the construction of roads and infrastructure, bridges and so forth, in the country. And, of course, this became a flashpoint issue over the past year when we saw the large bridge in Minneapolis collapse. Friedman says, excuse me. He says this is not an energy policy. This is money laundering. We borrow money from China and ship it to Saudi Arabia and take a little cut for ourselves as it goes through our gas tanks. What a way to build our country. The McCain-Clinton gas holiday, says Tom Friedman, proposal is a perfect example of what energy expert Peter Schwartz of the Global Business Network describes as the true American energy policy today. Maximize demand, minimize supply, and buy the rest from the people who hate us the most. And he says, good for Barack Obama for resisting this shameful pandering. He says, here's what's scary. Our problem is much worse than you think. It's not worse than what listeners of Pacifica think. We are very well informed about our energy problems in this country. But many who read other alternative media, the alternative to the truth, don't understand how bad our problem is. He says, we have no energy strategy. If you are going to use tax policy to shape energy strategy, then you want to raise taxes on the things that you want to discourage. Gasoline consumption and gas-guzzling cars. And you want to lower taxes on the things that you want to encourage. New renewable energy technologies. And Tom Friedman says we are doing just the opposite. I've said many times our tax policy is totally backwards, that we do not tax the things that we want to discourage, so that we bring about really social engineering for positive results. Our policy is the opposite. Friedman says, are you sitting down? Few Americans know it, but for almost a year now, Congress has been bickering over whether and how to renew the investment tax credit to stimulate investment in solar energy and the production tax credit to encourage investment in wind energy. The bickering has been so poisonous that when Congress passed the 2007 energy bill last December, it failed to extend any stimulus for wind and solar energy production. You got that, folks? The 2007 energy bill passed did not extend any stimulus for wind and solar energy production. But the oil and gas companies kept all of their credits, while wind and solar will expire this coming December. Friedman says, I'm not making this up. At a time when we should be throwing everything into clean power innovation, we are squabbling over pennies.
I find it's very, very discouraging when the, you know, presidential candidate leaders and Hillary Clinton, I thought, hoped she would take a deeper approach. It's a shallow approach.
She's trying to win an election, Randall, and what Friedman's saying is that Clinton, who knows better, and she knows better that that's not an energy policy, is pandering. She's trying to win a primary in North Carolina and Indiana this coming Tuesday, and Friedman says this is pandering. She's pandering to the truckers and the working class people who, admittedly, of course, are having economic stress in their lives as a result of the rise in gas prices. But he says if she were principled, you know, she would not accept this, knowing that that if anything, in a way, gas prices need to go higher. Bill McGibbon thinks gas prices need
Absolutely.
To go higher. Well, they need to go higher until our behavior begins to change. And we're only beginning to see the change in behavior.
Yeah, he had some great ideas. The key solution is to put a price on carbon.
Yep.
Which we talked extensively about Monday night, send a signal through the market to change habits. Commodities would get more expensive, but in the cap and trade solution he talked about, people would be getting a check. You collect all those.
Yeah,
you collect all that revenue.
I hadn't heard that. He called that cap and dividend. This was an mm-hmm. idea that I hadn't heard before, which is that carbon would be taxed, but there would be rebates at the end of the year to individuals, and therefore, when they went in to purchase items, the differential between products would be much clearer on the shelf, so that the purchase behavior of our country would be different, and yet the money ultimately would flow back. I thought that was a great idea. I hadn't heard that before. I mean, cap and dividend.
Yeah, giving it back to people.
Giving it back to people
and
while conditioning the pricing mechanisms in the system.
Right, and not letting Congress or the legislature choose technologies or where this money should go into research, but giving it back to people where it's needed. Al Gore had an interesting concept about this too. If you tax or put a price on carbon, replace the payroll tax with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's another form of giving it back to the people.
Yeah,
but lowering their Social Security
lowering their payroll taxes.
Right.
Here's just a little bit more on the Friedman article. He says, while all the presidential candidates were railing about lost manufacturing jobs in Ohio, no one noticed that America's premier solar company, First Solar, from Toledo, Ohio, I think they're based in Arizona now, folks. Those of you who don't know, First Solar, if you own stock in First Solar, and again, whenever I talk about investments on the show, I'm not giving investment advice. I'm giving you information, and so you must take it as such. But the stock of First Solar was up 800% last year.
Yeah, all the solar companies, I get Value Line, they've all been up in a huge kind of a way. I'm sure they, you know, slid down. Highly speculative stocks.
Yes. First Solar from Toledo, Ohio, was opening its newest factory in the former East Germany. 540 high-paying engineering jobs because Germany has created a booming solar market and America has not. 540 jobs, my friends, now opening in East Germany by an American solar company. 540 jobs and their dependents. So let's say the average family has in the East Germany, they don't have a lot of children there, say three. Average family's three. That's 1,500 people, dependents.
Yeah, McGibbon talked about the huge amounts of money to be made.
Yep.
In renewables.
It's enormous.
Huge, huge amounts. The Rockefellers came out yesterday berating Exxon Mobil, saying, you know, you're way behind. There's so much money to be made in renewables.
Let's pick that piece up. I've got it right here. The Rockefellers, who are the descendants of John D. Rockefeller, the creator, founder of Standard Oil, the business titan from the Gilded Age, his descendants who, of course, continue to live high on the hog on all the trusts that were created for them, and Exxon, which is the primary company, the largest of the companies, descended from the Standard Oil Trust. I think others are Chevron, as well, which was Standard Oil of California. Exxon, of course, is the largest. Wall Street Journal reports April 30th, the descendants of John D. Rockefeller are publicly calling on Exxon to change its corporate governance and take a hard look at the future of global energy supplies. A majority of 300 adult members of the wealthy Rockefeller family, influential shareholders of Exxon, voted to support four shareholder resolutions at the company's annual meeting coming up in late May. The proposals include urging the company to create an independent chairman post. That's one. Cut greenhouse gas emissions. Two. And examine whether Exxon should take a more active role in developing sustainable energy technologies. Randall, let's take each of these separately. One, creating an independent chairman post. What we know about governance in corporate America in the past couple of decades is how appalling it has been. And often this is because the CEO of the corporation also holds the post of chairman of the board. And the chairman of the board, of course, manages the board. And what is the job of the board? One of the jobs of the board is to set the compensation structure for the executives of the corporation. And so what do you have when you have the CEO, who is the chief executive, the chief operating officer of the company, also inhabiting the post of the chairman of the board? That means that person, he, usually it is a he, sometimes it's a she, runs the board, which is in charge of setting his or her, their own compensation. And this has created all sorts of problems, as we've seen in the past decade, with the absurd levels of compensation that chief executives have been earning. Not only in the case of when they're actually doing the job, often when they're fired. They set their own severance packages, and we saw this most recently with, what's-his-name from Home Depot. What was the guy's name? The guy got $200 million to get canned at Home Depot. I mean, this should not be a liberal, conservative issue. This is a governance issue of organizations that are some of our largest and most important organizations, many of which could be considered to be public trusts.
I think it's a fairness middle class issue.
Yeah.
When you see, you know, the growth in the last 15 or 20 years of income, it's been absolutely flat.
That's right. Middle class.
We've had undergone a middle class squeeze. Robert Reich had a fascinating editorial about the overall trends. The middle class began to feel it when the spouses, women, began to go to work, not necessarily because they wanted to, because they had to.
They have to.
And then it goes even further when we're reaching out even further for income. We're borrowing against our houses, the equity, going into debt. That's really the root of the financial crisis we're in.
Yep.
It's this middle class squeeze and the reaching out of people to find ways of getting some share to, you know, meet basic needs. But
As Friedman points out, we have companies that are ready and are innovating, ready to create jobs, and those jobs are being placed offshore, as are many of the jobs, not for the reason that that it's cheaper labor, but for the reason that the demand market there is larger. Back to Exxon, the second thing that the descendants of the Rockefellers are encouraging through a corporate resolution, which will be voted on at the shareholders' meeting at the end of May, cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, Exxon, an inveterate believer that it's fossil fuels and it's only fossil fuels, and therefore this would cause a change in the management of the company to cut greenhouse gas emissions within the company, as well as to encourage the cutting of greenhouse emissions in Exxon's customer base, which is, you know, you and me and other people and companies. And then finally, Exxon should take a more active role in developing sustainable energy technologies. What does that mean, take a more active role? Well, as we know, Exxon, I think today, reported earnings.
$11 billion.
$11 billion, my friends. $11 billion in profits. As I've talked about so many times on the New Capital Show, management of a company has four things they can do with earnings. That's it, four. Not 37, you know, not two, four. Number one, they can pay a dividend to shareholders. And they would do that if they felt that they didn't have investment opportunities themselves, the management. They would pay a dividend. That's why you see older companies tend to pay dividends where newer companies don't pay dividends. Newer companies are growing faster and need their earnings to reinvest in additional markets and growth in the company. One, they can pay a dividend. Two, they can buy back the shares of the company on the open market. Just like you can go and purchase stock through a brokerage, Exxon can open its own brokerage account and can purchase its own shares. What that does is that shrinks the pool of shares outstanding and increases the earnings per share that the remaining shareholders receive. So it's a way of paying a dividend, except there's no tax on it. There's no tax, so it's a backdoor way of paying a dividend. The third thing is that management can acquire other companies, which is a form of investment, right? Management can go out and buy other companies, and very often when we see corporate managements buying companies, they buy them for too high a price, they waste shareholder capital, and very often the acquisitions don't work out, right? Because the management that's acquiring wants to build an empire. Very often we see mergers not work out, and very often it's better to be bought than to be the buyer. Not always, but often that's the case. And then the last thing is management can reinvest in the company through homegrown projects. Right? And so, what is this saying? Exxon should take a more active role in developing sustainable energy technologies. What the Rockefeller descendants are saying is that some of the $11 billion, perhaps a large part of the $11 billion that Exxon has made in earnings, should be going into reinvestment in sustainable energy technologies. Companies like First Solar that are undertaking.
Well, I think the Rockefellers are also saying that the oil business may not be a very good business in the long term. When you look at the financial reports of most major oil companies, most are not replacing their reserves.
Yep.
They are struggling to replace their reserves.
You were in that business for a while.
I'm still in the business.
In the oil business?
I operate an advertising agency. My clients are in oil equipment. I'm still writing, brochures on drill bits and tubular products and blowout preventers. And what's fascinating is, to read a report by Matt Simmons that says, well, the Saudis just don't have the reserves that they say they do.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to product managers who are corroborating that.
Book is Twilight in the Desert.
In the Desert, right. And I'm talking to product managers who are involved in these exotic designer wells, these horizontal wells in Saudi Arabia, to try and get at the oil. It's not easy to get anymore. The supply is limited. I'm hearing that all the time.
Did they join Progressive Forum?
Who?
The oil folks.
Could they join it?
Do they? I'm just wondering. Do they say, "Oh, Randall, I didn't know you're doing this," and
oh yeah,
and they come to
the events. Yeah, they love the Ken Burns events. Mm-hmm. The veterans. Ed Schell sponsor our Redford.
That's true.
Event. They're joining us.
Here's an article. Here's an article. New York Times. Shortages threaten farmers. Shortages threaten farmers' key tool, fertilizer. This is an astounding article. I'm going to mispronounce her name. Trong Thi Na stands just 4.5 feet tall. Her 3 grown children tower over her. Just as many young people in this village in Vietnam outside Hanoi dwarf their parents. The biggest reason the children are so robust, fertilizer. Ms. Na, her face weathered beyond its 51 years, said her growth was stunted by a childhood of hunger and malnutrition. Just a few decades ago, crop yields here were far lower and diets much worse. Then, the widespread use of inexpensive chemical fertilizer coupled with market reforms helped power an agricultural explosion here that had already occurred in other parts of the world. Yields of rice and corn rose and diets grew richer. Now, those gains are threatened in many countries by spot shortages and soaring prices for fertilizer, the most essential ingredient of modern agriculture. Folks, one of the great discoveries of the 20th century, it happened in the early 20th century by two chemists, I think, Professor Fisher and Professor Tropsch. from Germany, was how to derive nitrogen from our air, and it involved the use of natural gas is used in the process, and it yields nitrogen. Nitrogen, of course, is one of the critical components for plants. And we now have chemical fertilizer. Of course, this results in environmental problems as well, since so much chemical fertilizer is used around the Mississippi River in places like Iowa to grow corn. What is not used in the growing process, the corn can only absorb so much. The excess runs off into streams, which eventually makes its way into the Mississippi River, and that eventually makes its way into the Gulf of Mexico. And what that causes is the growth of algae, massive amounts of algae in the drainage basins of rivers, and that chokes off ocean sea life. And so it's not an unmitigated good by any means. This is one of the things that's driven us to look again at organic fertilizer. Of course, it takes much more organic fertilizer to get the same effect. This article goes on to talk about the what strikes me as absolutely right. We're at 6 billion people and counting in this world, largely because of the invention of chemical fertilizer by Professors Fisher and Tropsch in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, that's where we've gotten the population explosion from. And any pinch in global fertilizer supply could have dramatic effects on the ability to feed 6 billion people and growing. Norman Borlaug, who was an American scientist who was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, for his role in spreading intensive agricultural practices to poor countries, he says, this is a basic problem to feed 6.6 billion people. Without chemical fertilizer, forget it. The game is over. And as we see right now, the pinch in fossil fuel supply, as we were just talking about, Randall, has resulted in the rise in prices of fossil fuel is resulting in the rise in prices of food, and it's resulting in shortages of food, and it is also now resulting in shortages of fertilizer. And so when we talk about a sustainable planet, Bill McGibbon would call it a durable planet, we're talking about levels of production, demand, population, and so forth that are sustainable. And the way that we've gone at it in the past century has really been very, very intensive. Bill talked about growth, and many observers and experts in economics have talked about the unsustainability of growth in this world and the way that we've achieved it, Randall, and how we've got to find another way to develop our economies.
Well, we're already at pinch points in the food. You know, we're seeing food riots in 40 countries right now.
Yep.
Because we're taking crops out of play. To turn them into fuel.
Ethanol.
And the Houston Chronicle wrote a very enlightened editorial yesterday, the day after we presented Bill McGibbon mm-hmm. to the editorial board, berating this ethanol mandate, quoting Bill McGibbon, you know, that we're taking food out of play. People need to eat to fuel our SUVs.
We've got great listeners. I mean, I can't say how many times in the past few years when we've talked about this impending use of corn crop for increase in ethanol, we get a KPFT caller all the time saying this is a disaster waiting to happen, taking food supply and using it to fuel ourselves. So should we take some calls? Why don't we open the phones up? We'll do a couple more articles. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. A couple more articles. And also, Elizabeth Edwards is going to be... Tell everybody
Elizabeth,
about the next event.
Elizabeth Edwards, wife of presidential hopeful John Edwards, will be at the Progressive Forum.
Former. He's not hopeful
anymore.
Thank
you very much.
He lost hope.
May the 21st at the Wortham. She has incurable cancer. She and John lost a son when he was 16 years old. She's written a book called Saving Graces, and it's about overcoming life obstacles and finding hope. And so this is a non-political event. It's an inspirational talk, Elizabeth Edwards, about overcoming life obstacles. It's May the 21st. Looking forward to that. Should be a very soulful, memorable event.
And... boy, do I know when you've got to get over obstacles and go on. That's what we were talking about at the top of the show. Forgiveness and
fallibility.
And weakness. Low spending is taking a toll on the economy. But, and again, when you read the news, folks, read it with a critical eye. Low spending is taking a toll on the economy. Maybe low spending is a good thing for the economy, you know? For months, writes Peter Goodman in the New York Times, beleaguered American consumers have defied expert forecasts that they would soon succumb to the pressures of falling home prices, fewer jobs, and shrinking paychecks. Now, the American consumer appears to be giving in. On Wednesday, the Commerce Department reported that the economy continued to stagnate during the first 3 months of the year, with a sharp pullback in consumer spending, the primary factor at play. Pressures on households in which cash is tight appeared to weigh significantly in the calculations of the Federal Reserve as it rolled back interest rates Wednesday for the seventh time, and on. More ominously, Americans cut back on a wide variety of discretionary purchases, conserving their cash for necessary spending. Discretionary purchases would be things like washing machines, things like automobiles. You know, they tend to be big-ticket items, but they don't have to be. It could be entertainment items and things like that. Even more ominous, oh, I read that already. In the dip, economists saw evidence that the basic laws of arithmetic are now impinging on millions of households. My friends, as I've talked to you about many times before, growth in an economy does not only have to come through personal consumption. And that has been what our leaders have built the economy on for the past couple of decades, and we are now seeing the fallacy of it. We're seeing the fallibility of it. Because you can grow an economy through investment as well. I've talked about the three components of gross domestic product. Consumption is one. Government expenditures is another, the second. And the third major one is investment. Net exports also, that's a fourth component. But let's leave that alone because often, except in our case, exports and imports balance themselves out. But investment is just as much a component of gross domestic product. And if we want to get this country going again, investment's what's going to do it. Investment in projects that yield returns. Going to war in Iraq does not yield a return. It yields negative returns. No return. Negative returns. There's no return that's going to come from that escapade. Investments in ethanol production, that's not going to yield a return. There are investments that are available now to this country, and we should be making them. Tom Friedman thinks we should be making them. Increasingly, many of our business leaders think we should be making them. Of course, we have problems with our tax code because it creates disincentives to make those investments. Disincentives. The news out this week is on the Farm Bill, and I'm certainly no fan of George W. Bush, but at least George W. Bush is pushing to eliminate subsidies from the Farm Bill. At least he's doing that. In many cases, we have Democrats who are standing in the way, Democrats from farm states. And that's going to have to play out differently, folks. You know, we've got to have our tax code aligned so that, as Tom Friedman points out, we tax the things that we want to eliminate and we set free those things that we want to encourage. Okay, the lines are full up here. People obviously want to get in. We've got about 25 minutes or so. So let's go to the phone lines. First, we're going to take Duke. Duke, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. I have a couple of comments. I'm sure you can disagree on every one of them.
Okay.
First of all, the reason why we're paying high price for gas and food is because liberalism, and it's just another example of how liberalism is a failure.
Okay.
What
is your solution, Duke?
Well, number one, let's quit making electricity with coal.
Okay.
And let's make electricity with something that has no carbon footprint, or nobody's ever died in this country. Unlike coal mines and transporting coal and digging coal, it's called nuclear power, but everybody's so afraid of it in this country, even though in Europe it's about 80% of their electricity.
How big's your house, Duke?
2,500 square feet.
And what sort of light bulbs are you using?
I got all kinds. Fluorescent. What's the regular, whatever that's called?
Is your house running? Have you undergone what I would you might call it an energy conservation program undertaken to cut energy use in your house? Do you shut off lights and turn up air conditioners and
all that? Here's the smart thing I do. I only have a one story house.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, besides that, and really, you save a lot of money on one story, trust me.
Well, my point is, isn't conservation and everyone in this country...
Everything.
Isn't undertaking those things a lot cheaper than building nuclear power plants, which are $7, $8 billion dollars a pop?
No, it's not. Because
it's not.
The electricity, you know, let them worry about that. Let the people who build it worry about the cost, because eventually, when they start competing, the cost of electricity is going to go down, because you got a little piece of a softball or nuclear power. You got these rods, and once you insert them, they start boiling the water. It's pretty cheap after the initial cost. Mm-hmm. And what will happen with the cheap electricity, those guys in a garage right now who are working on a battery that will get a car 300 miles, they'll have more incentive to make an electric car when the electricity's cheaper. Also, we need to drill oil. We need to increase our own supply.
And Duke, where would you increase the supply, and what effect would that have? Tell me where in this country found proven reserves of oil are enough to fuel this country's current consumption levels. Where are they?
Well,
in your backyard?
No, but I know where some is.
Where
in
are
Alaska,
they?
And I know where some.
How much in Alaska, Duke? How much?
There is plenty of oil in Alaska.
No, don't tell me plenty. I want to know the number. How many billion barrels of reserves are in Alaska, and how does that compare to the annual consumption of oil in this country? Do you know those numbers?
Well, let me tell you this.
Or are you going to blame liberals?
Instead of growing crops to make oil, let's just drill in areas we know there's oil.
How much, Duke?
Well, it's more than, I'll tell you this.
You don't know how much, do you?
Corn.
You don't know how much. Do you know how much?
Well, there's a lot of reserves. How many? Tell me how many of the reserves are.
Okay. Well, the number in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge is, the estimates are anywhere from 6 to 10 billion barrels. Do you know how much as a country we burn a year? Do you know that number?
Yes.
What is it?
No, are we burning 1 million barrels a day?
We burn 8 billion barrels a year and rising. And so the amount of oil proven in Alaskan reserves, including the largest untapped source, is maybe a year, probably less. Do you think that's going to make a meaningful difference to our country's future?
But it's going to help. It's going to help.
How much is it going to help? How much can that help? How much can a year or less of supply help?
Well, it's going to help because we don't have to grow crops and increase the price of food.
Okay,
let's
Duke.
Let's cut that stuff out. Thanks
for the call.
That's a failure.
Thanks for the call, Duke. I don't like this blaming liberals for our current situation, as you can tell. It doesn't make me happy. Now, nuclear may be a solution. There's a lot of debate about it. And let's face it, folks, there are some problems with it. Anybody who comes out and says, oh, nuclear, there's no problems with it, please. That's not the case. Next up, let's take Halcyon. Halcyon, welcome.
Hello.
Good morning. Welcome to the New Capital Show.
Yes. Well, I was very encouraged to hear that Exxon, I guess, investors are actually asking them to change course, so that's great. I just wanted to comment about the commercial fertilizer. One of the most hopeful things that I've seen come out in the last few years is a movement towards reinstating the food soil web through organic methods, and it's not just organic fertilizer. It's using compost and basically beefing up in that particular local area. So for Vietnam, it would be very different. But I just wanted to share that it's not just, you know, the commercial fertilizer. I mean, they've kind of told us that's what we've needed, you know, for a couple of generations, three generations now. But
Halcyon, the article that I mentioned from the New York Times talks about the increasing use among American farmers of hog manure. We've seen stories on these enormous manure lagoons that have developed in hog, in industrial hog raising practices, and a lot of that's run off. Now they're starting to use it and spread it on crops. But the article points out that the chemical fertilizer is 100 times more potent per mass than so. The hog manure can only go so far, and of course there are issues. If anyone listens to Jams Blue Show, there are of course issues with the way hogs are raised, and they tend not to be very humane. So that's one way to go. Composting, yeah, I don't know. I'm sure that, you know, there are lots and lots of organic experts who listen to KPFT and can help us in this and how we go about moving away from chemical fertilizer or supplementing chemical fertilizer. I don't have the answers. But the statement by Dr. Borlaug was simply that without chemical fertilizer, the Earth cannot support the population that it currently does.
Well, you know, I don't know a lot about it, but there's a group in town, the Organic Horticulture Business Association, that's really sponsored a lot of information sharing with trends to go organic among commercial landscape contractors. And I've just been very impressed. Elaine Ingham has a website called, I think it's the Soil Food Web, Inc. Mm-hmm. And she's now got laboratories all over the world. Obviously, she's had a lot of resistance from commercial chemical companies, but her methods seem to be working. So it's not just a, it's kind of going mainstream finally. So I'm somewhat encouraged, but of course, that has to be a long educational process.
Halcyon, thanks for the call.
Sure.
Randall, one of the main things that Bill McGibbon talked about, of course, was local farming. And this is a major focus of his efforts right now. By the way, we should mention his organization, 350.org. 350.org, if you want to jump over and take a look at them, they are working to increase the awareness about global warming and to bring pressure on governments to deliver stabilized CO2 content in our atmosphere at 350 parts per million, which is the safety line. But on this issue of local agriculture, talking about organic and local agriculture, a big focus of Bill McGibbon's
talk. Yeah, absolutely. His whole point is, you know, on the other side of cheap fossil fuels, where do we go? And how do we live? And what kind of economy and way of life should we have? And he, his thesis is, in his book, Deep Economy, is the great potential in community-based enterprise. And probably, in my reading, the first economist since Adam Smith to come up with a new viable model. And he points out, for example, that in Madison, Wisconsin, 20,000 people.
20,000 people on the weekend.
Farmers market. Yeah. And it's the fastest growing segment of the food industry. And
30% a year.
Yeah, and his book points out about these local economies all over the world that are innovative, cooperative, and far more efficient. He talks about Europe. He spent a lot of time on Europe. The Europeans use half the energy per capita compared to Americans. Half the energy. And they're more community-based. They're taking more you know, vehicles together. There's more cooperation.
No, they're not perfect. Higher standard of living.
Equivalent standard of living.
For half the input.
You know, how many fewer nuclear plants and coal plants would we have to build if we were using half the energy? And when you think about Texas and California uses also half the energy that we use in Texas. So it's not all about producing more oil. It's not all about producing and drilling in Alaska. There are some basic common sense efficiencies that we could be thinking about. And importing
and
food 1,500 miles.
Yeah, it's not one of them.
You know, on trucks using fuel. It was another point of McGibbon. Using locally grown crops and food is far more tasty as well. You know, he talked about flying from California to Houston and how tired he was, and just think how a tomato feels. It just the same way. It's just a tired tasting tomato.
So we'll probably see more local agriculture. Let's take some more calls. John, let's take John. Welcome to the New Capital Show, John.
Hi, it's great to be on the air. I had a few issues to discuss with you. First off, when we're talking about electricity and nuclear power versus coal power, I think that that what you were talking about conserving is the primary method of reducing energy costs. And I think that if we educate people more on how much they could be saving by conserving or by doing methods like that are very, you know, in the home, might be a lot more effective. And another way I think you could reduce energy costs is by, I mean, you see how we cut the Fed interest rate to 2% yesterday, but that really was supposed to stimulate investment, when that in actuality, I don't think it really did much, because companies need to report, you know, profits for their shareholders. And when they're not producing, they're not going to be investing. And that ties back into the consumption side of the economy. When people aren't buying, there's no reason for companies to invest.
Yep.
And then you were talking about just recently about organic fertilizers and foods. Again, I think that education is on a much more, you know, local level. When he was talking about how a tomato feels, it's true that you don't get the same taste out of a tomato that you do if it was locally grown.
That's right.
And I'm just, you know, I definitely agree with you guys there.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the call.
All right.
Let's take caller Bill on line two. Welcome to the New Capital Show, Bill.
Hello, Leon.
What's on your mind?
Yeah. There's an interesting connection between a couple of the points you've been talking about today. Back in 68 or 9, I guess it was, when I was working at Temple University, we had an IT guy who was on the early version of the Internet, which was, of course, largely related to national defense. And he used to ask us, you know why we're in Vietnam? And, of course, I was ignorant. I said, well, you know, defend ourselves.
You said, not really.
He said, not really. He said, oil. And he said, yes. He said, yeah, South China Sea is the reason that we're in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
Which, of course, goes to the connection with the other point you were making. About
I'm sorry to interrupt, Bill, which is exactly why conflict arose between Japan and the United States in the Second World War.
Exactly.
Over the oil supplies in that region of the world.
In Indonesia, particularly, yes.
Yep.
Absolutely. So history does, unfortunately, repeat itself over and over, and the failure to learn from our past errors is tragic.
Bill, thanks for the call. Great to have you.
Right, bye-bye.
Okay, we just got a few minutes left. Listener John writes me an email and says, when you urge listeners to sign up, I'm not urging, I'm encouraging, to sign up for the New Capital Show newsletter, promising updates. We're not getting updates. Folks, we're working right now on our weekly newsletter. We've updated it, and we're about to start sending it out. So that's why we haven't sent much out in the past couple of months, as we've been working on an update to that. Stephen Reitman's working on that. I'm doing some work on it too, but if you do want to sign up for the newsletter and to have the shows emailed to you or the monologues, all that's going to be included in the package that we send out. You can do that at newcapitalshow.com. And Progressive Forum is progressiveforumhouston.org. Since
exactly.
Randall's our guest this morning, and you can get an awful lot of good stuff there. Just a few minutes left. Let's take GD has never called before. Let's take GD. Yes, GD. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Yes, you're on, GD.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one or two questions and then listen to your responses to that.
How about one question, GD, since we've only got a few minutes left?
Okay, let me put it to you this way. You know, we seem to, pursuing the philosophy of maximizing profits all the time. And I can't find anything wrong with that, but at the same time, it feels that there should be a higher purpose, you know, about this time of our development, you know. So, you know, is the maximizing profits the end all that we should be pursuing for eternity? I mean, is that all you see, you know?
Yep, I got the question. Thanks, GD. I'm going to hang up and I'll answer. I think that there is an emerging consensus that what we should be maximizing is happiness. Happiness.
And Bill McKibben factors in human contentment as new economic model, which now we're able to measure. And he talked, for example, about farmers markets. Sociologists now know that you have 10 times as many conversations at a farmers market than you do going through your neon-lit grocery store.
That's right. What Randall's pointing out is that it's going to take changes to the essential structure of our economy to increase the level of happiness. There's several components to it. One is utility. This goes to if you've heard of Maslow's hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't have anything to eat, you're not thinking about the way you're thinking about contentment. What can make you happiest quickest is food, and then a steady supply of food, and then shelter. And so as we go up the level of the hierarchy from the material to the psychological, then the utility of adding additional things goes down. Bill McKibben, we've talked about Bill a lot today, but he talks about a lot of these things in his new book, which is called Deep Economy, and I recommend picking it up and reading it, because he covers lots of these issues and how economics is interrelated now to psychology and utility and issues like that. The notion of utility is, if I have $1 million, the next million's not going to be nearly as valuable to me as the first million. But if I have $2, $1 million is going to be very, very valuable to me. And in the case of American society, for many of us, the utility in different sections of our lives, we've already exceeded the point where utility benefits can accrue to us any longer. You know, Bill talks about his daughter's stuffed animal collection. She's got, 30 of them. So one more stuffed animal isn't going to mean that much to her versus a young child in another country who doesn't have a single stuffed animal. And so ultimately, the drive should be for happiness. And what a lot of people are finding, and I, in my work as a financial advisor, I find this to be the case, that even with extraordinary amounts of money, it doesn't bring you happiness. Happiness has to come from something else, GD. I think it's an excellent question that you ask. I think we've got time for another call, maybe two, but let's see. Let's take Frank. Frank, you're on.
The largest community inner city farm is right here in Houston, out on the east end.
Tell us about it, Frank.
Between Waco and Clinton. It's called Email Farms. It was put together by Joe Isep with his own time and money. And my question is, what do you think about Derek Jensen? What is his writings? What do you think about what he has to say?
I've not read Derek Jensen. Is he someone I should read, and is it shameful that I haven't? Tell us about him.
Well, he says that it's over. No matter what we do, it's over.
It's over. Meaning, what's over?
Well, civilization is going to collapse as we know it.
As we know it, I don't know if it's going to collapse. I'm hopeful, Frank. I wouldn't say it's going to collapse. And frankly, we're working real hard at New Capital Show and Progressive Forum so it doesn't collapse. But certainly it's going to change. There's no question that change is going to happen. And I'm very sanguine that it's going to happen in very, very good ways. I think people are getting it more and more. And I'm going to let you off, Frank. I'm going to close the show on a little piece about people getting it here. The news out of the latest Wall Street Journal. This is the Wall Street Journal poll, folks, right? So support for Republicans falls. only 27% of voters have positive views of the Republican Party, according to the latest Wall Street Journal NBC news poll. The lowest level for either party in the survey's nearly two-decade history. My friends, that's a staggering fact. When I started doing this show 5-6 years ago, that party was riding high. I strongly disagreed with their policies. I felt that they were going to lead to dead ends and were not going to lead into the future. And there were many people who shared that belief at the time. It seemed incredible when I said that I give the Republican Party 10 years, and people said, you're nuts. In fact, it's happened sooner than that, and 27% of voters. So what I would simply say to Frank, people are getting it, people are changing, and the money's going to follow, the investments are going to follow, the minds are going to follow, the behavior is going to follow, and we're headed toward, I think, a much happier society in the future. That's my belief. NewCapitalShow.com. Do please sign up for the newsletter. We're going to be sending it soon, and we think it's going to be really good. And Randall Morton, it's been a pleasure having you here today. You said you were going to be nervous going on the radio.
I am
there was
still
no nervousness.
Hey, you're a great coach, and I have enjoyed it, and you've initiated me.
Today's show, of course, engineered by Laura Slavin and Bob Wilkerson as well. Great to have the two of you as always. I'll be back with you next week. I hope you have a great week. Until then, take care.
On Saturday, May 17th, a number of Houston's musicians will gather at Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, 1031 East 24th Street in the Heights, to celebrate the music of Bob Dylan. Ranging from solo to full bands to jams, this collective will provide a roller coaster ride of thrills, chills, and spills just for your ears. Thanks Bob 5 is a KPFT benefit and a Dead Air production. If you dig Bob Dylan music and would like to hear it interpreted by many of Houston's finest players, this is the event for you. The $15 cover goes straight to support community radio. Smokin' Joe Montez, Chris Collins, Pat and Rosie, and me, Sandy, will be there to host this important musical happening. See you on Saturday, May 17th at Dan Electro's. And now, you know there's something happening, and you know what it is, don't you, Mr. Jones? 90.1 KPFT Houston. Hey.
This is Chandrakanta Courtney inviting all KPFT listeners to attend a special performance of classical and modern Indian dance by Namita Bodaji and Samskara Academy of Fine Arts from Mumbai with special guests Houston Azerbaijani Folk Dance Group. The performances take place at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th at University of St. Thomas Jones Hall and 7 p.m. Sunday, May 4th at Rice University, Hammond Hall. For more information, please see...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.